But the bottom line is God gives you all of your directives, all of your cornerstones for knowledge, so that you can be certain that what you know, you really know. And that's the point of Job. Okay, so the point of Job, okay, implicitly is, but mainly, okay, I mean, these are two main themes that are actually going on the same time. And when I was doing the course with the men, I had this in one sentence. But as we went through, it was just easier to separate them. Okay? God's divine revelation is necessary, meaning epistemological certainty. Epistemology has to deal with the study of knowledge. Okay? And you really only have two options for the study of knowledge. Okay? You either tell yourself why you know things to be true, or you receive knowledge from something outside of yourself. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. Honestly, the book of Job really simplifies things like parenting. I don't think you can just look at your kids and say, do what I tell you to do because I said so. Is that true? I mean, that's true. I said it. God gave me the authority to say that. So be quiet and do what I tell you to do, because it's in Deuteronomy. Okay, but the question, I think, for a child is, how do I know that what you're telling me is right? You know, because I am not the grounds for my own epistemological certainty, right? So epistemology, the study of knowledge, okay? God is the grounds for my epistemological certainty, and that's what this is pointing out. So when you're talking to people about knowledge, you have to get to that divine backstop, the point at which people do things for their bottom line reason. So the Bible is very simple. Romans 1 presents it as people do what they want to do because they exchanged the glory of God for an image in the likeness of man, right? And so why do pagans do what they do? It's because they think themselves to be God, right? Proclaiming to be wise, they became fools. So they have this grand epistemological certainty called secularism, right? Science, all of these things that you have heard, and they use all of these disciplines to wax very eloquent about the position that they come to, but it's really just a house of cards. Because why is history true? Why is science true? Why is whatever discipline you choose to emphasize for your epistemological certainty, why is that true? It's because God has declared it to be true. And this gets into the idea that God is the best person at every single job. I think that's fantastic, right? He knows the piano a million times better than Terry. Okay, he knows the Bible 10 million times more than I do, right? He understands what a CFO is. He'd put Austin to shame, you know. He'd put Carrie to shame with facilities, right? Right, I know. I crossed between my dad and Austin. Yeah, same line of work, but similar undertakings they have, or should I say they had. So that's what Job really attacks in its entirety. How do you know what you know to be true? And the bottom line is, for you, God really said that, declared that in his word. If you don't have that, what do you have? If you don't have the word, what do you have to go with? Right, you. And that's a problem, because let's talk about experience. Okay. Talk to me about your experience. Yes. How so?
That you've only experienced it
This is true, but why? So why does that make you limited?
You don't know what other people are going.
Okay, so you're limited by your person. Okay. True, but why? Give me reasons. Okay. Did the Vietnam War happen? Did World War II happen? This was a fun game that I played with one of my high school students. This is great. Because he was like, yeah, the Bible's not true. It's not historical at all. And I'm like, you're right. Neither is World War II. Right? Because you didn't see God. I didn't see World War II. I've seen videos. I think they created that. Right? So I don't think World War II existed. And so every punch he threw, I mean, I obviously think that World War II existed, okay? But but it was just funny because, in a sense, all reasoning is circular because you don't have a place in your own experience to go above the world and understand how everything works together. Hence, you need to be dependable on God. Hence, atheists need to be dependable on themselves, right? So you're not really getting down to like the bottom reason why. Why are you limited? Good, good. That's one factor. Time, good. You weren't near World War II, right? Some of you might have been. Man, do we have anyone here that would have been alive during World War II? Not quite. When were you born?
46.
Wow, close. Okay. 48. Okay. Yeah, so, you know, and we're losing our World War II vets, right? I think there's a limited number of them alive, and you could even see it in the collegiate education, right? You know,
yes.
You go to these state schools, and it's like, you know, you give people a picture of Donald Trump, and I love talking about Donald Trump in these. I don't know what it is. He's just such a magnetic personality, but it's Trump. It's going to be huge, okay? You have Trump, and you got Adolf Hitler. And you give that to a standard person on a school campus, and you ask them, which one of these people is worse, right? It's amazing. They will put Trump almost every time.
And they have no clue.
Right. You know, and it's like, then you have to explain to them World War II, that really happened, and there's this significant character in World War II. See, all that has to do with knowledge, right? And they don't have that knowledge because no one talked to them about it, and they haven't researched their history and all of those other things. Does this make sense? So time is a big factor because if you don't see it, people like to think that it doesn't exist, okay? So, you know, God doesn't exist because I don't see him. Well, great. I don't see your brain. I don't think it exists. You know, I don't see gravity. I don't think it exists. I don't see oxygen. I don't think it exists. I mean, if we play that game forever, you're going to start to realize, wow, I believe in a lot of things that I don't see. Okay? And that's because you sense them. That's because you see them. That's because they're historical, you know? And that's where the Bible really comes in with the category, right? It's historical. And that's why 1 John opened with what idea? I'll talk to you about it in like a week and a half. Okay? Right. What is he appealing to? Right. History and their knowledge. And see? What is this?
Your ear.
Right. Sense. What is this? Sense. What is that? Sense. Now, John didn't write that. Right? And we even smelled him. But he could have. Okay? He could have because I'm sure they smelled him. Right? I'm sure they smelled the aroma of the perfume, for example. Right? He could have said that. It's like, how much more definitive do you want me to be? This is knowledge. Okay? Good. So, one thing you are limited by is time and your person. Right? What else? Big one.
I don't, maybe this goes under time as well, but you can't be everywhere at the same time.
Exactly. Space. Yep. You're limited by space. You're limited by a few more things, but we'll just leave it there for now, and you can, you know, you're all smart. You can figure out what you're limited by.
Would you think of what it would be dimensions as well, because God is everywhere all the time, and in all the times.
Right. Yeah, I mean, time and space are the two big ones, you know. And then everything kind of comes down from there. But that's why Job is so important, because it gives you epistemological certainty outside of yourself, the certainty of what you know really being true. Okay? And that's the battleground, by the way, between you and everyone else. Okay? Christians, your epistemological certainty is God. Everyone else, their epistemological certainty is themselves. You with me? Okay? Good. All right. That's really the crux of Job right there. Okay? So if you're good with that idea, where knowledge comes from, you're going to do well in Job. Okay? A couple of things to cover before we really get going. Okay? Good question. Epistemological certainty. Okay. When did the events of Job take place? Anybody? Somebody?
Early.
Really early. Okay. 1800. 2000. 1800. We defend that today. Okay. I'll answer this in a second. Okay. When was it written?
Later.
No.
During the
patriarchy. Right. So, not difficult.
A little later than it happened.
I will just say, here, 2000, 1800 BC, okay? We don't need to be that accurate, you know. I can understand what you're saying, because obviously you have to write the events after they happened, okay? Unless, I mean, you know, it's funny though, in our epistemological certainty, does that even have to be true? Right, because God just comes and says, look, this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen in the future. So technically speaking, right, there's a debate among conservatives, right? Who wrote Deuteronomy 34? Moses or Joshua? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I don't know. But I think it's rather interesting that the thesis that some are defending, that Moses could have written about his own death. I mean, what's the difference? I mean, is God going to be fooled by that? Oh, I didn't know you were going to die on Mount Nebo. You know, that really caught me by surprise, you know. No, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, sovereign. I know. So Moses really could have written Deuteronomy 34. It's, you know, because you have to understand what your faith is grounded in, right? Your faith isn't grounded in reason. Your faith is grounded in God, and God is the one who invented reason. So reason actually goes back to God. Reason doesn't defend itself, right? That's actually circular logic, okay? Reason is defended by God's existence. Are you with me? This is why his characteristics are so important, okay? Good? Does it matter when it was written? Answer?
No.
Ooh.
Yes.
Yes.
I missed
yes.
one.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's last week.
It's all right. Listen. You're all going to be wrong here. That's what I tell the men on Monday. I'm like, you know, if you're not willing to be wrong, then you're not going to learn. And it honestly, it took me a long time to learn that. I was always, like, shamed when I was wrong. Now, like, I go into, I went to a class, actually, for shooting guns not too long ago. And I'm just such a different student. It's so fun, you know. Like, if I'm wrong, I don't care. I just look at the instructor. You know, if he's giving me a hard time, I'm like, well, obviously I don't know why. I've interacted with you enough. Can you please tell me why I'm wrong? You know, so it's kind of fun. I'm just not afraid, which is good. So, yes, it does matter. Okay. Now we've covered these two factors here. Okay. Early Hebrew language, ancient Near Eastern parallels. Any questions about those before we begin? From last week. You might not have any. Okay. Point of early Hebrew language is that the characteristics of the writing itself, as you see it on the paper, proves that this is super early, even earlier than Moses' script. Okay. And this is really funny because the seculars want to say that the ancient Near Eastern parallels are late or early. No, early, right? Because what they did, and it's ironic. So like, yeah, they flip, right? It's like, oh, the ancient Near Eastern parallels, those are the early ones. But Job is like way down here. And it's like, no, if you read Job, Job makes a lot more sense than what I read to you. Do you remember what I read to you at the end? Right? It's very, the text is very beat up. It's discombobulated. It's unconnected. It's simplistic. Okay? That ancient Near Eastern parallel. I actually have a sheet if you want to look at it, Marion. It's, you know, it's that long. It's not that, not that long.
Not the stack of sheets.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions about that? So what we're defending is that the ancient Near Eastern parallels are later, which is funny because I think the earliest parallel that you have is about 1600 BC, which if our little thesis holds here, this is earlier than those. Good? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, great. All right, internal evidence for Job, okay, and the timing of Job right here. So this is where we start to answer these two questions and defend, okay? My thesis is that they took place in the patriarchal period. Patriarchal period, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, okay? Let's first look at the first issue, okay, which would be Job's age, okay? Anyone know how old Job was?
One thing I was watching last night said he was around 100. I don't know if that's true, but I was wondering myself. Was he about 100?
Yeah.
At the end, he was about 240 when he passed.
Right. So, well, it doesn't tell us how old he was when he passed. It says...
But it says that he lived 140 more years.
Right.
So
correct.
That's why Yeah. He was about 100, he was probably about 240.
Right. So I would go a lot younger than that.
Really? Okay?
Yeah. Okay. He's probably 40 when this happens. Okay? Maybe 50 or 60. Okay? And that surprises people because it's like, oh, he's an elder at the gate. Well, yeah. You know, accomplished. Yeah, not sure if he had grandkids. Right? Did it say he had? I don't think he had grandkids in chapter 1. I think he might say that in 42. But
it might have been further.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I'll show you why in a second, okay? I want you to see it, and if I state it sometimes, I get ahead of the text, and you don't get to see it. So, okay? So, first thing I want you to notice is in Job 42:16, okay? That's your base, okay? Says very clearly, okay? 42:16. Yep, all the way at the end. Second to last verse in the entire book of Job, 42:16. Okay, Marion, you can hammer that out for me.
Sure. Job lived 140 years after this and saw his children and their children to the fourth generation.
Okay, there you go. Okay,
so
saw them to the fourth generation. So, you know, I don't think he could be much over 200, really. I mean, 60... Him being 60 when he gets through this is pushing it, okay? And here's why, okay? Let's turn back to Genesis. We're just going to look at a lot of things, okay? Because I want you to see this. I don't necessarily want me to continue to tell you. I want you to see the basis for yourself and just kind of make your way through it, okay? I'm turning to Genesis 25. And then we will be in Genesis 35 and Genesis 47. Okay, Genesis 25:7. Anyone who's ready, we'll just do it that way.
I can read. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life that he lived 175 years.
Okay, so if this takes place in the patriarchal period, Job pushing 200 is rather quite impressive. Okay, and we'll continue to prove that. Genesis 35. Okay, because from Abraham on down, you don't get older, okay? You get younger because sin is taking effect, right? You die earlier. That's the idea, okay? Actually, I'm going to stand corrected here because Isaac's just a bit older, but not much, okay? Genesis 35:28.
Now the days of Isaac were 180 years.
180 years, okay? So we've gone from 175 to 180, and then finally, We are in Genesis 47, 28. I'll take that for you. Okay. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. Okay. So if Job is a contemporary of Jacob, okay, Job had a longer life than Jacob, you know. That's why I think 40 or 50 is probably pretty good, okay? And then finally, you see that Joseph's life totally drops off. Genesis 50, 26. And anyone who has that can take it.
What was the last one?
Chapter 50, verses 26.
The last one.
Oh.
47, 28.
Thank you. So we're going down, we're not going up. So Job, I mean, Job's got to be early. It has to be, I mean, 2000 BC is a good guess, okay? 1900 is nice because you get, you know, the best of both worlds with 1800 and 2000, right? But it's really early according to Job's age, okay? So that's factor number one in internal evidence in Job, okay? Factor number two, okay, back to Job 42. It's this unit of currency, which is fantastic, because this unit of currency, okay, is blatant. It is explicit. It is not, you're not able to confuse this, okay? It's called a casita, okay? It's a very old unit of measurement applied to monetary currency, fiat currency, okay? And where we get this from is in Job 42:11, okay? Job 42:11. Anyone who wants to, yeah, I'll just say this. When I say read, anyone just go for it. Let's just do it that way.
Then all his brothers and all his sisters and all who had known him before came to him, and they ate bread with him in his house, and they consoled him and comforted him for all the calamity that Yahweh had brought on him. And each one gave him one casita and each a ring of
gold. Oh, they actually put it in there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good for them. All right. NASB, right? NASB is like, they gave him a piece of money. Now, I mean, that's good, you know, because it is a piece of money. But, you know, it would really be helpful if they have a note, say, piece of money from the time of the patriarchal period, because that's good. That's what it is. Okay. Oh, well, all right, you have to have a note there that says that it's from the patriarchal period. Okay. How do you know it's from the patriarchal period? Okay. I'm going to go to Genesis 33:11 for you. Okay. Yeah.
Q E S I T A H.
Oh, you said.
It's from the old times.
It's from the Greek, probably.
Yeah. I was going to say, Terry, the correct spelling is cove, sin.
It's either Greek or Hebrew.
Oh, Hebrew.
Or it
could
be.
Yeah.
Aramaic.
The old. Tav and hey. Genesis 33:11. Okay. Okay. Says this, please take the gift which has been brought to you because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have plenty. Then he urged him and took it. Okay. That gift there, do you have a, oh, you're not there. You're not there either. That's okay. Go ahead and flip there. 33:11. Okay. That also is a quiseta, okay? Quesita, however you want to pronounce it. 33:11.
Please take my blessing. Yeah,
mine doesn't
say.
Doesn't? It's a.
Please take my blessing, which has blessing. Been brought to you because
wow.
God has dealt with
yep.
me.
Yep. Present. Okay. Yeah, you got to love that, right? You know, and I get it. right? You have an option in Genesis to translate it differently because, you know, you're in a different book, and I get that. But it's helpful. This is where biblical theology, right, as an academic movement, not as like, my theology is biblical. Okay, we're not talking about that. Biblical theology as an academic movement is making leaps and bounds with the text, because what's happened is that everything is now in a computer, right? And numbers of dissertations are being written on lexical links and linguistic links, and they just, you know, they have the ability to find all these very, very quickly. And so one of the ways that biblical theology is affecting your world, okay, and you don't even know it, you're like, it's almost like you're in Leonardo DiCaprio's Inception and you don't know it's real, okay? Which, in fact, that is a perfect movie to describe the what's going on in Job, okay? You guys probably have never seen that. Inception, anyone? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you about that sometime. You know, I have so many movie references when I talk Bible, because I'm telling you, like, every movie comes from the Bible in some way, shape, or form. It's so annoying. Yeah, right. It's ridiculous. You know? It's like, stop stealing. Give the church some of that money, because, you know, we're in charge of the scriptures and you're stealing from our material.
Yeah, but
if you
go to the church, right?
Right. Well, that's just, yeah, Terry.
So 33. Which word in there? Gift.
Yeah. Gift. Mm-hmm. That's a quiseta. Okay. And also, all right, Judges, okay, or no, Joshua 24, okay, see it again. Now, Joshua, you know, it's a little bit more forward in time, but nevertheless, it gives you the same unit of measurement, Joshua 24, 32.
Now they buried the bones of Joseph, which the sons of Israel brought up from Egypt at Shechem, and the portion of the field which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 kesetah.
Okay, see, that's Jacob, right? So again, that is actually, so it's forward in time, but it's actually talking to you about what happened in the past. So this very clearly is saying that a kesetah is what? A unit of money measurement that belonged to the patriarchal period. And lo and behold, when you look at Job 42, right, his brothers and sisters are giving him the same amount of money, the same type of money. Does this make sense? I mean, this is a real link for me that is big, because it links you not just to the story, but it links you to the entire society. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Right? So that's quite significant.
Internal evidence, you're saying internal biblical, not internal only to Job.
Correct. Yeah. Okay, but I mean, it is in Job, because it's,
It is in Job, but I'm saying internal as in relation
to
other.
I'm matching it up. Yeah, no, that's true. Yes. And in a sense, you have to match Job up with everything else, because Job is what? Job's first. So you don't have anything, right? Unless you have a kesetah in the same text, you know, then you can compare and contrast the way that it's used, but, you know, you don't have that. And you're not going to have that, because Job is so unique. I mean, remember, there were how many hapax legomena? I think 180, okay? And then you had 60 that, you know, you can't define the root word with, you know, pinpoint accuracy, which, you know, kind of presents a problem for translation, okay? Last issue, internally. Anyone know? I mean, You should probably, if you think about it, you should know it. Job. Why is Job early? Because
there are no other scriptural. There are no other. There's no reference to the temple, the tabernacle, the law.
That's good. Okay. Yeah, I shouldn't have asked you this, because you're all going to take my thunder, and that's fine.
Or who he's related to.
That's true too. What? That's true as well. Not what I'm looking for.
So it just starts right with Job.
Okay. Something very, very, very explicit.
Creation.
Wealth. Livestock. Right?
Yeah.
Remember?
He has
lots of livestock.
Yes.
Okay.
Start
Right. Okay. And how is wealth measured in the patriarchal period? Livestock. Livestock and livestock. Okay. I'll show you. Okay. Job 1. All right. Job 1, verse 3. Okay. He says this. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys. We'll go over that in detail later. But there you have his wealth in terms of livestock. And it's the same thing for Abraham. You see that in Genesis 13, verse 2. Abraham was rich with a lot of livestock. Abraham's wealth being measured in livestock, Genesis 13, 2. Job's wealth being measured in livestock, same thing. Okay? Same thing. Also, just in case you don't see, I'm building a case. I'm like a lawyer in court, man. I want you to be able to put people to shame. I mean, that's really not the point, but I'll tell you a quick story one time. So when I was doing Job for the men, and you know, when I do it for the men, I go all out. You know, it just takes me over. And one day I went to the coffee shop, and the guy behind the counter is like, "Oh, what are you studying now?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm studying Job." He's like, "Yeah, man, that is a great book. You know, I never really understood the key to Job until now." And I was like, in my mind, I'm like, man, those are dangerous words, right? So if you're going to say that, you better know what it is, okay? And I'm not saying that you can't. I mean, you certainly can know what it is, but when you're, this is what it was. And so out of his mouth, he said, "I never realized that when you pray and persevere in the Lord, he's going to give you double." I'm like, yeah, that's not the point. That's not the point. And when we get there, you're going to see the danger of making that the point. That's ridiculous. The fact that God doubled what Job had serves a completely different purpose to the entire book than what that guy thought that it served. And, I mean, I just said put people to shame. You know, he's behind a counter, a coffee shop. And I knew him fairly well, so I could have said something. But I knew that if I did say something, we were going to get into an hour conversation. And so I just was like, oh. I think I said something like, I don't think that's the point, but that choice of interpretation is out there, you know, or something like that. He's like, well, yeah, that's what I think it is. I said, okay, great. I hope you have a wonderful day, you know. And I'm not trying to be condescending, but it is just sad that you have this confusion, right? If you read it very carefully, that's not what it's about, okay? What the doubling factor there, okay? By the way, is for this. Why would God double what Job has? What's that say?
Revelation.
God's divine revelation is necessary. Yeah. So, Job, he just got through the disaster. Does he have divine revelation? Does he?
He has a little more than he had before.
He has more.
He has zero. That's the whole point. He has zero. It's not like God wrote this down for him and said, oh, hey, by the way, I was just kidding about all that, and here's what was going on, right? He didn't do any of that. What did God do to show Job that, hey, this is enough for you to trust me? What did he do?
Double.
He doubled his stuff. Exactly. He doubled his stuff. Why? Because the security blanket of divine revelation was not there, right? And so this is actually conflictive with the Pentecostal charismatic movement, right? Job got that because there was no divine revelation. There wasn't a Bible. There's not, you know, God's not speaking. And so what did he say to Job? Here's all your stuff so that you know that I'm blessing you. Okay, because you had right theology, right? He did say that, okay, because obviously, it is true that he had more.
A teeny bit more.
Yeah, because God spoke.
Spoke to him.
That's true. That's true. You're right. Okay. You're right about that. So I won't say zero. I'll say one. Okay? Okay? It's true. Good job. Yeah. Wait. Yeah. Good. That was, that's good.
No.
You're right. Very clever, Terry. Hey, whenever you're in doubt, just use the text to prove people wrong. It's perfect. Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah, there is more divine revelation. When I say he doesn't have any, I mean there's nothing written. But you're right. He doesn't need something written because God showed up. Right. And spoke. And what did God do? Here's your stuff. Right? But, okay, the reason why I look at it that way is because did God give him the answer to his questions?
No.
So he doesn't give him the answer to the questions. He just says, here's all your stuff. Not just, you know, back, but double. You know, all right. And so that's why it says Job lived out his years, like, in fullness. Why? Because God is blank. Right. And who knows that now? Job. Who didn't know that while he was going through the whole thing? It's really funny. You know, Job in chapter 9 has a meltdown and is like, you know, it's all one with you and you don't care about anything. Therefore, I declare that you find the just guilty and you find the guilty innocent. Your justice is flawed. You know, it's like, wow. Okay. That would be a great passage to show the children, right, in your Sunday school classes who are like, is Job a sinner? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he just called God unrighteous. Is that correct? No. Good answer, Zeke or whoever, right? Good job. Okay. All right. So we talked about the livestock. Okay. Yeah, I'll answer your question. So we got three. Okay. We have three now. We have Job's age. We have Job's currency, and we have Job's livestock, okay?
Oh, I was just going to say, if he didn't give him anything at the end, he would have died. Because he didn't have anything with which to
right.
live
sure.
life.
Yeah, it's true.
About.
Yeah.
And so he doubled it. Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is, he was good to let him live.
Gracious.
After
yep.
everything he did.
Which fits in with our theology, doesn't it?
The
yeah, it fits in with our theology, right? Because, okay. Now, does it always happen? I mean, can a kid who's 6 years old have some kind of degenerative disease and pass away in a year?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. But at the same time, what is your rule of thumb? Right? Let me tell you what the rule of thumb is with God. He protects those who are his. He really does. Because what did he say? I'm going to build the church. So, you know, we might be in a crazy time in America, but it is a perfect time to have children, and for those children to be indoctrinated theologically so they go out and cause terror in our world, right? It's going to be fantastic, okay? Because they need to proclaim the truth to all these crazy companies, to all these crazy people who, oh, well, you know, you're a woman, but you can be a man, you know? No, you can't. In fact, when you do that, you lose your entire identity, and that's why you end up committing suicide. Not because you're hurt, but because you are lost, right? So we need truth. And what does God do? He protects the family. He protects the church, right? Does it mean he protects every church? No. Okay, look at China. Look at North Korea. Right now, they are going through awful, awful times. But the Lord is going to be faithful to build his church, right? So you and I don't have to worry about the government looking in on us or, you know, God is going to have his sovereignty, his way, and he is going to build the church. That's what it's about. Okay? You with me?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And we know that persecution has to happen in order for the church to grow, so it's not going to be an easy, we have 10 more people today.
Right.
Kind of situation that's not going to be pretty.
Right. Yeah.
Because we are supposed to suffer in the name of Christ to grow.
Yep, and that's the context in which John 15 was used, that statement, right? Do you think you're greater than your master? James and John are like, well, maybe. No. Okay, you're not because I'm going to suffer. And if you love me, you think you're not going to suffer? You are going to suffer because you're just like your master. You're following your master. And the master set the precedent, and you are following in that precedent, you're going to suffer.
Corporate solidarity.
Right. Right. It just filters down. Okay? Good. Corporate solidarity, by the way. Does everyone understand that term? Corporate, lots, solidarity, one. Christ representing us in many different areas, right? So we just kind of vicariously live in him, and he takes us to the finish line. That's the idea. Okay? Good. All right. Next. Okay. Evidence in society. I will also be using internal evidence from Job, but this fits nicely under this heading. Okay. Evidence about society. Okay. Did this society believe in God? I mean, for lack of specificity, okay? Did they think that there was God?
Yes,
they did, of course. Now, obviously, the Egyptians got confused with that, and they have panoply of gods, right? But nevertheless, they think of the world being run by deity, okay? What did they call God in the patriarchal period? Anyone know? Okay. Genesis? No, but you're on the right track because God is actually using his name
There's a difference between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2.
Yes, right? That's not where I'm going. Right. But so God himself is defining himself in Genesis 1 and 2. Okay. Where I'm going is... Oh, you know what? I don't think I wrote the passages down. Well, that's a bummer. Okay, so let's do this. Okay, I'm going to say Exodus 6, just off the top of my head. I'm hoping I get lucky here. Yeah, okay, I got it. All right, good for me. Fantastic. Okay, Exodus 6:3, okay. You can start in 2, and whoever wants to read can go ahead.
God spoke to Moses. He said to him, I am God. I appear to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, I'm going to do
El Shaddai. El Shaddai. Oh, good. Hey. 10 points for that Bible, all right, in that spot. Okay.
This is the complete Jewish that I was telling you about.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it appears he appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai. Although I did not make myself known to them by my name, Adonai. Also,
ugh.
How far do you want me to go?
Oh, you can go through 3. That's fine.
That's 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's 2 and 3.
Not good. Okay. It's not Adonai. Okay. That's the tetragrammation. Okay. The tetragrammation is like... Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey, that's the name of God, right? And then the Masoretes put in the vowel markings for Adonai. So hence they say Adonai instead of Yahweh, okay? And it's Yahweh, that's his name, okay? But it's actually, if you think about it, it's quite disrespectful of the Jews to not use God's real name. I understand that they think they're using it to be respectful, but the truth is, Carolyn, Caroline. I mean, I know that hopefully Carolyn and Caroline aren't so sensitive about their names because people are going to get it wrong quite often because of the short and long I, but nevertheless, it's more respectful if you're in a relationship with Caroline, right? Oh, Caroline, that is your name. I respect you enough to use your name, right? So Yahweh is very important, okay? But that's not the point. The point is El Shaddai, okay? Genesis 17:1, Genesis 35:11, Genesis 48:3. Okay, here's the bottom line of El Shaddai in the Book of Job. Okay, El Shaddai is used 41 times. That's huge. That tells you how they refer to God in the Torah. okay, talking about patriarchal times, El Shaddai used 9 times, 6 times in Genesis, and not really anywhere else. And that's the big point. Not really anywhere else. I mean, you might be able to find it here or there, but it is predominantly a patriarchal term for God's identity. So how is the society referring to God? They are referring to God as El Shaddai, the Almighty. That's what that says. Okay, that's what that means. The Almighty.
So you're saying this points to it even being early, because...
Correct. In patriarchal period.
Right.
Yes.
Job, and then not used.
Right. I mean, and it's significant because they're in... I mean, is Genesis a conversation?
No.
It's a story. Right. Yeah, it's a family history. That's what it is. Right? Is Job a conversation? So what... and it's a conversation about who? Right. So... if you're going to use a term for God, and it's going to be El Shaddai, and you're talking about God, how often are you going to see that? A lot. 41 times in Job. And that's why you don't see it as much in Genesis. It's because it's a historical narrative, right? It's not like you're having this big conversation about who God is. So that's why it's used less in Genesis. But nevertheless, that's how they referred to God in Genesis, as El Shaddai. These guys are talking about God as El Shaddai.
Where are the other three?
Well, obviously, Exodus 6:3 is one of them. One of them is Deuteronomy, I think. There's one in Deuteronomy, I'm pretty sure. In fact, I would venture to guess that the other two are in Deuteronomy. But I don't know.
Not outside the Pentateuch.
Correct. I think you can find it maybe a few times outside of the Pentateuch, but it's not heavy, and that's the point. You might, by the way, you might be able to find it in, like, Psalm 90.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, sorry, Mom. Go ahead.
How do you find it if it just translated Lord or Yahweh?
Yeah, no, that's, yours is different. Read yours.
Well, in Exodus, it just translated Lord.
No, read it.
Well, not Exodus.
Oh, of course. Okay.
Well. The Lord appeared to Abram.
Yeah, keep going. That's it right there. I am God Almighty, El Shaddai. Yep, God Almighty. Okay?
In front of in Genesis 6:2, the Yahweh has a special dot in front of it, and then God Almighty also has a special dot in front of it.
Interesting.
To indicate that's obviously a different... Okay. But then I have a note for 3 that says it's El Shaddai. 6:3.
There you go. Okay. Good. All right. Next societal factor that proves.
Exodus 6:3, not Genesis.
Oh,
Exodus.
Yeah.
2 and 3, yes.
Next factor, okay? Job's awe factor. Okay, there's reverence. Lots of reverence for Job. Okay, and this is just the nature of these times. For example, okay, Job 12:12. Okay, but see, don't write this down. We'll do this later. Don't write Job 12:12 because you're going to be like, okay, this is what, you know, and I'm going to throw you for a loop there because he's actually using it as like a swing post to swing the pendulum the other way, okay? But he does say wisdom, Job 12:12, is with the aged men and long life. With long life is understanding, right? So he's saying something about experience being an awe factor for people who are older in that society. Okay, but when we actually get here, he's going to turn that all in his head. Okay, so that's why I don't want you to write it down, because you're going to think that he's using it as a positive. He's actually using it kind of as a negative. Okay, turn over to Job 29. Yeah, you can write this one down. But this one also is flipped, though. So just know that, because it's, well, if you're really good, like if you're amazing, you'll pick up on what's going on. You know, it's tough to do when you don't understand the flow. But why don't you go ahead, 29:7-11, I want to say.
When I went out to the city gate and took my seat in the town square, young men saw me and withdrew, while
Okay, so Job is saying here in 29, and I'm basically giving you what's going on here. So now the offer's off the table. No one's amazing. Because it took me too long to figure it out. So he's saying, hey, back in the day, this is who I used to be. I'd go and I'd sit in the square, and people would rise and they'd stand up. They'd even give me their seats, you know, and the young people, they would all run because I'm at the city gate. Me, right? Okay, continue.
City officials stopped talking and covered their mouths with their hands. The noblemen's voices were hushed and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. When they heard me, they blessed me, and when they saw me, they spoke well of me.
Yeah.
I rescued the poor man who cried out for help, and the fatherless child who had no one to support him.
Yeah, then he goes on for giving you reasons why he thinks this way. Okay, fair enough. All right, but the point is the establishment of reputation is made secure by the text, right? Obviously, that is a big part of their society, okay? And even Ezekiel 14:14 even picks up on this. Let me just read it for you. Ezekiel 14:14, even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in its midst, in the midst of Ezekielian times, which were a disaster, okay? Some of the worst times ever. By their own righteousness, they could only deliver themselves, declared the Lord God. In other words, they wouldn't be delivering their families, they wouldn't be delivering anyone around them, because the knowledge of God was so bleak at that time that the judgment of God completely took over in the times of Ezekiel, and therefore Job, Daniel, and Noah would only deliver themselves, right? So there's awe factor there. In Ezekiel 14, Job and Daniel and Noah are considered to be great, okay? They're not considered to be feeble, right? Oh, man, these people are weak, you know? No, they're great, okay? And the point that he's making in Ezekiel is that these men are so great, don't think that anyone else could come in and deliver anyone else because they couldn't even do it. Are you following me? Okay, good. All right, so the awe factor, okay? That's the second issue for the society. Third factor, the family social unit, okay, in the way it functions, okay? Everyone turn to Job 1. The family societal unit and the way it functions proves that you are in patriarchal times, okay? Job 1, 4, and 5. This is kind of sad.
His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one of one on his day, and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. Now it happened, when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, that Job would send and set them apart as holy, and he would rise up early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to their number of them all. For Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually.
Okay. So, I mean, this is good from Job. It shows you his priestly nature for his family, and that's the point of the patriarchal period, right? Who functions as the priest?
The
father, the patriarch of the family, okay? How do we know this? Exodus 2:16. That's your other parallel, okay? Exodus 2:16, the priest of Midian. Who was that? That would have been Moses' eventual father-in-law. He was functioning as priest in Midian, okay? Because he's the patriarch of the family. Now, that's a little earlier, okay? But nevertheless, it still holds. And, by the way, in case you don't buy it, who functioned basically, it doesn't say it, but in function as a priest in his family in patriarchal times with a very key event in Scripture? Close. Okay, but you need one link. You're missing a link. Okay? This is good. Okay? Right, because what's Isaac functioning as? A sacrifice, an offering. Okay? So here Job is offering offerings, right? Abraham is offering an offering, which happens to be his son. So there you see Abraham is actually officiating on behalf of that transaction, okay? Isaac for the glory of the Lord, okay? Isaac for worship of the Lord, okay? With me? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, I think at this point it's an open shut case, but, you know, I continue. Why not? Okay. And let me say this, you know, you said this, Robin, you know, and you're right, okay? No Abrahamic covenant, okay? Why not? Because it's too early. There's no divine revelation, okay? No Exodus, no law, no Israel, right? All of those are coming. So Job functions as a precursor. Can you believe it? As a precursor to the Abrahamic covenant. That's crazy. Because Abrahamic covenant was really, really early. Okay? Now, it doesn't necessarily prove that the Abrahamic covenant wasn't in existence. It just proves that it's not wide knowledge. Okay? So Job is not talking about that because he doesn't really know about that. All right? And finally, okay, someone turn to Genesis 11:28. Okay? And someone else can be in Job 1:17. And, just for fun, why don't we go to Habakkuk 2, someone else. Habakkuk 2, oh boy. I gotta look at it, so I want to say 4 or 5, maybe 6, maybe 3. Yeah. Why? Man. And it's always embarrassing when you can't find the book. There it is. Okay. Just passing it a ton of times. Oh. Okay, yeah. This is... Okay. This is a little bit different, a little bit more implied. Okay. Habakkuk 1:6, and you can read 2:4. Okay. You're gonna get an extra thing today. Congratulations. Okay. I don't like necessarily doing things off the top of my head because, you know, you reveal how much you don't know. So not that I'm trying to be proud, but you know, you just don't want to do that in class because then you set yourself up for a fall, right? There's a value in preparing for people, so that should actually be more of humility because it proves to you how much I need to prepare to, you know, speak. Okay. Genesis. Where were we? 11. Yeah. Who's got that?
And Haran died in the presence of his father, Terah, in the land of his birth, in Ur of the Chaldeans.
Ur of the Chaldeans. Very specific. Okay. Job 1.
1:17.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Chaldeans, okay? That's good. Chaldeans, early, okay? Now, we could prove that just with history, but I'm going to prove that theologically to you, okay? Who has Habakkuk 2? Great. Oh, yeah, 1:6 first, right. Forgot about that.
1:6. Yep.
Yep.
I'm raising up the Chaldeans.
Chaldeans, boom. There they are. Okay, now, that's good. Okay, so... Who are the Chaldeans, actually, at that time? I mean, it's Habakkuk. You're in 610 B.C. Who are they? You're like, they're the Chaldeans. That's what the text says. It's true. They're the Chaldeans, right?
In the complete Jewish, it says
Chasdim. Right, Chasdim. Yeah. Chasdim. Yeah.
Translated Chaldeans.
Yeah, right. The Chasdim. Okay, but who are these Chaldean people?
Okay.
They are raiders. See, they're taking it back in the history too. So they're helping you by giving you that note. But I'm gonna help you theologically, right? So we know that historically the Chaldeans are early. But Chaldeans became the right. Right. Okay. So it's like, okay, think about this. All right. Think about this very clearly, okay? Habakkuk is really smart, What did he just do? What do all these people know these people as? Right? The Israelites. Right? Habakkuk just said, hey, the Chaldeans are coming.
What's
Well, that's true. But what does Israel know them as right now? The Babylonians. They're like, you know. See, these are the things that you need to pay attention to, right? So Habakkuk, right? Oh, the Chaldeans are coming. And they're like, okay. Yeah, that's their root name. But we all call them the Babylonians. You know, why would you say that? Here's why he would say that. Habakkuk 2:4. It's a word picture. It's a picture of identity. And he's using this, like, object lesson to prove what they need to do theologically. Okay? You'll get it here in just a second. Right? You're confused. It's okay. You'll figure it out.
2:4.
Yep.
Look at the proud. He is inwardly not upright. But the righteous will attain life through trusting faithfulness.
Right. Well, the just shall live by faith. And all of you are proud. Okay? Where did you get the just shall live by faith from? Anyone knows where? Does anyone know where that starts in Scripture? The just shall live by faith. Right. Genesis 15. Okay. And so what is Habakkuk saying to the Israelites at that time? He's saying, look, you guys have your temple. You got your kings. You have all your songs, like in Jeremiah 7, one of my favorite passages. It's hilarious. You know, Jeremiah says, you know, you're all singing this stupid hit song in your... See, they had hit songs back then, and you think MTV was evil. Now it was evil back then, right? So, you guys are all singing this song called The Temple of the Lord, you know? And this is how you remember it. It has the same syllabic pattern as We All Live in a Yellow Submarine, right? Right? So they're all singing, this is the temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord. And Jeremiah comes in and he says, stop singing that because it's stupid. You know, you think you could cheat God by just, you know, like the Israelites carrying out the Ark of the Covenant to go to battle, and then you lose the Ark of the Covenant and you're like, oh no, it's gone, you know, and it's right because you're disobedient, you know, and you're not faithful. So you guys have to go all the way back to the beginning, get rid of your temple, get rid of your kings, get rid of your pride, get rid of all this false religion, and just trust the Lord like
Abraham.
Okay?
Isaiah 1
says the same thing. Yes. Oh, yes. No, it does. So, but in Habakkuk, right, and that would be another question, right, who is quoting who, right? And, you know, it's Habakkuk quoting Isaiah quoting Genesis, right? And you just kind of put a skewer through it, right? Because they're all trying to prove to you the same thing, okay? I mean, the people in Isaiah's time are just as bad as the people in Habakkuk's time because, you know, that's the slide. You're all going towards Babylon at that point. But anyway, okay, to put this together now with clarity, okay, Terry, because you were looking confused, okay, here's the point, all right? Why did Habakkuk call the Babylonians the Chaldeans? Because they're an object lesson. What he's saying is, hey, you got to get hit over the head with a mallet just in case you don't understand Habakkuk 2:4 that the just need to live by faith. Think about the Chaldeans. You mean Babylonians? No, the Chaldeans. Well, they were way back when. Exactly. Just like what you guys need to do. You need to go way back when so that you can trust the Lord. Keep it simple, stupid. Get rid of all your false religion, and you'll have it figured out in the time of the Chaldeans. Got it? Okay, we understand. Yeah, but they were hard of hearing, right? So the authors used like word pictures like that to jog their memory, right? So that's why you're in Habakkuk, and he calls them the Chaldeans when they are actually the Babylonians, but he's trying to get them to jog their memory like, oh, yeah. He's doing everything he can to get them focused on Abraham and how he came to the Lord by faith. You with me? That all proves, that theology right there that Habakkuk just did, right, proves to you that the Chaldeans are late or early?
Early.
Okay? It's not just in the history. It's in the theology. Do you see that? Right? He actually makes a theological point about the early nature of the Chaldeans. With me? Who's not with me? I feel like we lost people. Okay. Okay. All I'm saying, okay, let's just boil it down to this, okay? I am proving to you that Job is early, right? One of the things that proves to you that Job is early is the use of the Chaldeans, because the Chaldeans existed in Abraham's time. Habakkuk proves to you that the Chaldeans existed when? In Abraham's time. Yep, there you go, right? Yeah, see, you just need to get me off all the theological track and just say it in two sentences. All right. Okay, how we doing? Good? Mm-hmm. All right, this is going well. Okay, so.
Where did the Chaldeans come from anyway?
Ur of the Chaldeans. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. They're similar nomadic peoples. Okay, maybe even the same nomadic peoples, actually. Okay.
I read 800.
I mean, yeah. I don't know about that.
800? How can
I mean, they're in existence probably in the 800s because, you know, they're the Babylonians.
I just looked it up real quick.
Yeah. But, I mean, Chaldeans, they're all the way back in Genesis chapter 11. So that's like 2200. Okay. You got to be careful who you read on dates, right? The evangelical world is completely split on dates, okay? And I'm conservative and proud of it, all right? I'm not, you know, I am Exodus guy 1446, right? You don't have that. You're not saved. I mean, kidding. But I mean, really, I mean, if you mess up the timeline, you actually start messing up the theology, right? So I'll save myself from any shame I may experience on the recording later. All right. So, we have answered these two questions definitively. Okay? It's very difficult with all the evidence that we put forward to say, oh, this is not happening in 2000 or 1800. I mean, it clearly is. Okay? And oh, this wasn't written in 2000 or 1800. It clearly was. Because they're talking that way. They're thinking that way. The use of the language. I mean, to make an argument against that, to me, is just crazy. I think it's absolutely crazy, okay? All right, now, we're going to handle these two questions fairly quickly, and we handle our final issue of the day, authorship, okay? Question, all right, how does the Old Testament and the New Testament handle authorship? I mean, have you ever thought about that before? I mean, just... not necessarily explicitly, right? Because it can do that, right? I, Paul, am writing this letter to you with my own hand, right? So they can state that, but do most books state that? No, they don't, okay? So this is why I'm asking this question. How does the Bible really handle authorship? What happens with the author?
He is.
Not most of the time. What about in John? Right? What does John say? It's great.
In the beginning.
Yeah, he does, but what about himself?
Oh. Beloved.
Right, good, yeah. What?
He calls himself the beloved.
Right, I am the beloved disciple. Do you see what he just did? Okay, what about Matthew? Very clever, right? Matthew introduces himself as someone that... the readers of the book should hate, right? In Matthew 9, right? But does he tell you, oh, I'm Matthew and I'm writing this with my own hand? No, he just tells you that, you know, my original name was Levi. He doesn't even say that, but his original name was Levi, and Jesus called him Matthew, and Matthew was a tax collector, right? And the Jews are reading this like, if we knew that guy, he'd be dead. And it's really funny because it's, you know, it's like, actually, I'm the one who's writing the letter, right? Mark, same thing, okay? The sheet guy, remember him, right? Somebody captures a sheet and he runs out naked. Why is that in there? It's an implicit eyewitness connection, right? Do you know what all these authors are doing? Ooh, Luke in Acts, right? The we and I passages in the way that he describes healing sometimes, like in Acts 3, it's hilarious, you know? Because it's like, oh, that's your job as a doctor. That's why you use this medical term for like strengthening in the legs. You know, you think like a doctor. So Peter says, oh, rise and get up. And Luke's like, wow, you no longer have any stress fractures in your tibia. It's like, why did you put it like that? Why didn't you just say he got up and he walked? He said that because Luke is a doctor, right? So the New Testament, the Old Testament handle authorship by presenting cameo appearances in the text. I would say old as well. Cameo appearances in the text. Okay? Moses is the same kind of thing. Okay? Even though it does say that Moses wrote it, but there's, you know, there's like this really funny parenthetical insertion. Oh, it's like in Numbers 12, you know, where Miriam and Aaron are attacking Moses, and the text says, now, there wasn't a man more meek on the earth, more humble on the earth than Moses. I'm sure it killed him to write that. It's like, can't write that about yourself, but okay, you know. The Bible allows these guys to make cameo appearances in the text, right? So you're looking at a couple things. Is an author provocative? Yeah, they are. I mean, John is provocative, okay? I'll get to you, Audrey, in a sec here, okay? Provocative. Okay? I mean, 1 John, is that provocative? Mm-hmm. Right? If you say that you have fellowship with God and walk in the darkness, you are a liar. Mm-hmm. Are you sitting there thinking like, oh boy, you know, what a lovely sentence. I mean, especially if you're struggling with your faith. If you're not struggling with your faith, we love it because we're like, yeah, that's right, you know? So provocative, second, they're unique, and third, they have sometimes an introduction. That's what happens where? In the book of Job. Okay? Audrey, hit me.
This was from John MacArthur's author and baby. He went with Moses first, but then he said, and he mentioned, I went down there and he mentioned the Midians and also Solomon. Mm-hmm. Also the possibility. The next paragraph.
He says all that because it's all historical precedent given over by more liberal writers.
The next paragraph goes through just what you went through.
Mm-hmm.
Right now.
Yeah.
The same thing.
That's my job. Right? Hopefully in more detail. Hopefully you'll say, hey, you should write this. Okay. All right. Good. Okay. So. Yeah. Who's unique in the book of Job? Like, really unique. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, Job, or Elihu? Who's unique?
Unique.
Who's unique to that group of five? Oh, it's clear. Job, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, or Elihu?
I feel like Elihu, but yeah. I feel like Austin's mentioned Elihu. And that's the only face
good.
Going on.
Yeah, no, go with Austin. Right? Elihu's unique. Why? Because he's not even involved in the system of conversation. they have a system of conversation, right? They're constantly arguing back and forth. And see, you've read it so many times that Elihu's not unique to you. And I get that, right? But Elihu is unique because you finished the rounds of the discussion. And here's how you're supposed to be thinking in the narrative. Good, I'm glad that's over. Then Elihu. And you're like, no, please don't. Just stop, you know, like don't talk, you know, you might have something good to say, but I've had enough, right? Can we just be over with this whole thing, right? So Elihu is unique because he's not involved in the original discussion, okay? Elihu is also provocative, okay, because he says some things that are out in left field. Whew, boy, that's also the narrative, right? The narrative as it goes, right, if you're like, what's the thing for earthquakes, a seismic reader or something like that?
Seismograph,
thank you. Okay, so like as you go, right, you know, the conversation gets more and more out of control, and by the time you get to the third level, it's like, whoa, this is, but Elihu comes in, and what happens? You know, it's like, oh man, you know, you're, because he said some great things, and you're like, wow, that is beautiful, you're right, you know? And then he's like, he goes way down in the depths, and you're like, whoa, what was all that? I'm going to justify you, Job, and now you should be tried to the limit because you're a loser. It's like, whoa, take it easy, you know? But the point of that is to show you what? What do you need?
Contrast.
No, what do you need? You need divine revelation. Otherwise, you and I are just going to go do what? Right? It's just going to be one big earthquake because we can't ground ourselves in any epistemological certainty. Yes?
What is
I'm
all
jumping
that?
Ahead.
Yeah.
But if Elihu was the author,
mm-hmm.
Could his divine revelation be prophetic in the sense that God showed him what happened in heaven in a vision like Isaiah?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Once you climb the bridge to inerrancy and you really understand what that means, in a sense, everything's prophetic. Right? Because, what does God have to do? I mean, this is the great thing about Job. What does God do? Does he do things in secret for us? And we're like, oh, we don't understand what you're doing. No. God just shows up and he says, all right, Moses, here's the deal. Write this down. Okay. You know? And that's actually the big argument in liberal scholarship. They always say that everything's late because the Israelites aren't smart enough to know these things. A point at which we agree with the liberal scholarship. I totally agree with you. I just handle that entirely differently.
But
right?
It has nothing to do with Israel and their capabilities.
Exactly.
Or intelligence.
And that's the point. Right? Right. You know, and they say, so because they couldn't know, they developed these things later. And I'm like, no. They developed these things really early because God needed to tell them first, right? That's how they knew these things.
In Job, without divine revelation, how did anybody know what happened in heaven?
Right.
Between God and Satan.
Exactly. Yes. Agreed. Yes.
How do you jump from the text and what we know about Elihu's conversation and what he said and how Job responded?
Yeah, let's answer that question. Okay,
what?
Elihu. How do we know that Elihu is the author? Answer: we don't. This is an educated guess. Okay, how convinced am I that I'm correct? Fairly, right? I'd give my. Oh, I'm going to show you.
Okay.
I'm just stating the facts so that you write them down and then we go over them, right? I'd give myself a fighting chance. I'd like to. Yeah.
So you said provocative, unique, and I don't know if that introduction is.
Introduction. Yeah, introduction. The authors get an introduction. Let me ask you a question. Who gets an introduction in Job?
Elihu.
Right, and Job. There's only two. Right? And you say, what about the three friends? They don't get an introduction. I mean, you find out where they're from. But you don't get families, you don't get anything. It's just Eliphaz the Themanite, right? Bildad the Shuhite, right? The joke is he's a foot tall. Bildad the Shuhite, anybody? Come on. All right.
Elihu has those, you're just misrepresenting. Elihu has all those three qualities, unique, provocative, and an interesting.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And now
okay.
You're going
to
tell me why
you're so yes. Okay. Let's go to 32, 1 through 5, somebody, and somebody else, okay? Genesis 22, 20. This will explain everything, okay? Couple of things for you, Terry, okay, and everyone else, obviously, because you're taking the class. Okay, Elihu. Okay. He is... Oh. My God. Okay. Good name or bad name?
Good.
He is my God. Good name. Okay. Hebrew name, strong name. That tips you off to who might be the author. Okay. Job, enemy. Good name, bad name?
Bad.
Bad. Enemy? You don't want to be the enemy of God. Right? But there's a purpose to that. There's a reason why God has done that. Okay? All right. Who had Genesis? No, no, no. We'll do Job first. Job 32, 1 through 5. You probably don't need to go all the way to 5, maybe like 3.
Then
yeah.
Nope. Oh.
She took it away. All right, go ahead.
Then these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. But the anger of Elihu, the son of Barak.
Okay. So you hear that? Elihu, stop, son of Barakel. You don't get that anywhere else. Continue.
The Buzite of the family of Ram burned against Job. His anger burned because he justified himself before God. And his anger burned against his three friends because they had found the answer.
That's so funny, you know. I hate my three friends because they're stupid. Okay. Elihu. All right. Okay. Son of Barakel. Okay. The Buzite family of Ram. Okay? All right. Genesis.
What?
22:20 and down.
Now it came about. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Now it came about after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, Behold, Milcai also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz his firstborn and Buz his brother.
Okay. Nahor. What did you just find out?
That he had a firstborn Uz.
Yep, Uz and Buz. Okay. There you go. Okay. Now, who is Elihu? Who read it? You did. Who's Elihu?
Buzite,
right? So he's in this line, okay, and not very far removed, okay? Now, Nahor is the brother of who? Abraham, bingo. Who is related to Abraham? Elihu. Right? And he's probably, you know, a couple lines down. Okay? Maybe only two. Okay? He's not very far removed. That's the point. Okay? Which, by the way, a son of Barakel, sometimes son can mean grandson, or it just depends on the context. In this way, there's no way, in this case, there's no way to be sure. Okay? So we have Elihu in the line of Buz, in the line of Nahor, who belongs with Abram. You with me? Now here's the seal in the coffin. All right. Look at that.
Abram.
What do you see?
Ram.
Thank you. Who is of the family of Ram?
Elihu.
I don't think there's any question that Elihu, in my mind, is the author. Okay, I'm crazy. People call me crazy for that. I'm all right with that. Okay, I've come to a point where I can accept that. Yeah, great. Family of Ram, Barakel the Buzite, related to Nahor, related to Abram, and with this all makes sense now. How did Job, the book of Job, get from Edom into the canon? Elihu becomes transfer man. Elihu is a contemporary of Jacob, right? And that's how it gets down into Egypt, and they have it, or maybe they stored it somewhere. Who knows? But the point is, Elihu is a direct link to the Israelite line, okay? And if you need, you know, Ram in context with the Israelites, Ruth 4:19, of the family of Ram, who's of the family of Ram? David, okay? 1 Chronicles 2:10, same thing. Who else is in the line of Christ? Matthew 1, 3, and 4. Family of Ram. Okay, so Elihu becomes a very, very integral character for all of this to go through. He is the transfer man to move Job from Edom into the list of Bible books. Okay, he's in the canon. Okay, so final question. Does it matter when it was written? Yes, because if it's written in 2000 BC, 1800 BC, and it's the first book of the Bible to prove that divine revelation is necessary, yes, it does, because Job becomes a prequel to set up all the questions that need to be answered in the Bible. That's exactly how Job functions, setting up all the questions that need to be answered in the Bible. And you will see them. I mean, that statement right there, you should write that down and circle it like in red. Okay? Job sets up all the questions that need to be answered in the Bible. Okay? Job sets up all the questions that shape the Bible. You'll be in shock. I promise you. You'll be like, wow! I didn't know that premillennialism was in Job. Okay, the idea that Christ comes first to set up the kingdom. But Job actually says that. Okay, you'll say, I didn't know that, Psalm 8, in an inverted way, was in the Bible. In the story of Job. Okay, there are all these connections from Job that go outward, right, as questions. And the reason why God doesn't answer the questions of Job is because the same questions that Job brings up about himself, God needs to answer for who? Humanity. So Job is like the gateway to the world in terms of wisdom, which would make sense because this is taking place in Edom. Edom, if we look in Obadiah, I didn't even go into this, but Edom is a place of trade and wealth and people. It's a melting pot for wisdom. So this is taking place on the grounds of, supposedly the most wise city that there is, and God is kind of using it as a background to make fun of humanity. It's like, oh, this is one of the best that you have? Edom? I'm going to show you what true wisdom looks like by me speaking over the period of the next 1900 years or so. Question.
I'm not trying to be funny, but this is giving
Yeah.
I am now just
you need to get into the Yeah. Let's keep it simple, stupid. Okay? Job is the prequel to the Bible. That's what you need to remember. Job provides divine revelation, or the need for divine revelation, for the rest of the Bible to take place. And one of the reasons why Job's questions aren't answered is, again, because they need to be answered for everyone else. You answer them for Job and you close the book. What's the problem?
They're hopeless.
Right. No one else has it. Okay? So Job is the gateway of the wisdom of God. And Job shapes the way you're going to read your Bible. And the reason why you have information overload is because I laid out a bunch of dots that are like that you're going to actually just go through this whole year. Okay? And you're like, I don't know how to put that all in my bank right now. That's what introductions do, okay? So you're overwhelmed with dots, but the reason why I gave you all the dots before is so that you would, have a chance of going through the text and recognizing things that we talked about here. So you're good if you don't get it right now, like in its entirety. All you need to really know, theme, purpose, and the idea that the authorship, in terms of its time, it matters, right? Because it sets up Job being a prequel.
I'm still back on the Eli Jew as the author.
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, you're making that educated guess, like a jury may find someone guilty based on circumstantial evidence. Like, there's pieces of the puzzle that are indicative.
Correct.
But you don't have an eyewitness that said.
Correct.
This person did.
Well, in the only, see, here's another reason, right? Let me give you reason number three. Job, now, my dad kind of shot a hole in this, but I don't think that was right, but it's all right, I don't think Job could write it.
I'm not saying Job did, but.
I understand.
Somebody else, I mean, who?
Agreed, but do you have anyone else?
Not that we are aware of.
Agreed. Yeah, so if you're going to throw somebody else in the mix, there's no way we can even be definitive about that.
Right.
But the Bible usually does not work that way because you have cameo appearances, right? And you have introductions to authors, and you have the provocativeness of the authors in the text, okay? I agree. So Give me another one.
Okay, wait, let me think.
True. Yeah, those are, yep. But if you actually go through the Psalms, you will find out that there are like 10 more that David clearly wrote. Point in case, Psalm 71. I mean, if Psalm 71 was not written by David, my name isn't Kyle. And there's just no way. You know, there are so many things that match Davidic writing early on, later on, in Psalm 71. Correct.
Is an educated guess based on various factors.
Yes.
But it is not a definitive.
Correct.
Non-debatable certainty.
Yes. It is debatable.
I mean, non-debatable certainty. Like, it's not 100% true.
Correct. Yeah. But I think it's right. Job can't author it because that's the whole point of his life. The whole point of his life is to be the experiment. You open up that experiment and you give him what he wanted, the experiment is over, right? And that's the point. The point is for him to function as an experiment, right? So the only other guy who receives a significant introduction is out of the debate of authorship by nature of what he is accomplishing for God. Good? We're all tired. Oh, this is wonderful. We'll finally start the book next week.